Welcome to Tuesday's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. We are glad that you are with us today. Coming up a bit later in today's show, the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival is entering its ninth season, and this time the Bard is packing his bags for the Badlands too. It will be performed this summer free in Grand Forks and for the first time in Medora. Plus, Dr. Tom Ezern will have his Plainsfolk essay, and it begins with a bang, Sitting Demai. What started as a quiet cultural footnote on the prairie has grown into a full-blown celebration of Norwegian-American identity. And in classic Ezern fashion, there's pride, politics, and a library with more than just books on the shelves. And as we begin Main Street today, we're taking a closer look at a recent brine spill in Williams County that released more than 3 million gallons of produced water, a byproduct of oil extraction, into the environment. Now, we had a listener reach out after our news summary last week to point out that brine spills can actually be more damaging in the long run than oil spills, a point well worth exploring. And to help us understand why, we're joined by John Ellingson, a licensed professional and certified professional geologist and the Fargo operations manager at Terracon, an employee-owned consulting firm that works on environmental, geotechnical, and infrastructure challenges nationwide. We wanted to visit with him about what brine is, how it's used in fracking, and what makes it so harmful, and what's done to prevent and clean up these kinds of spills.
So, John, welcome to Main Street.
Thanks for having me.
John, what is brine relative to hydraulic fracking?
Brine is, it's kind of called a lot of things, produced water, brine, salt water, and it's all kind of the same thing, kind of used interchangeably. So basically, when the oil comes up from the ground, when they're pumping it out, it comes with oil, gas, and salt water. It's kind of all mixed together. Come to the surface, they separate it out. The oil goes this way for refinery, the gas goes this way for refinery, and the pipeline will bring the salt water to a disposal well where it just goes back down a well into a similar or the same formation. So it's kind of used interchangeably, but the terms brine and salt water and produced water are all kind of the same, big picture, yep.
There might be other chemicals with the salt in this produced water?
Yep, and it's pretty much pretty similar, close to ocean water, how all these formations were formed at one time were, you know, they were ocean water, they're ocean deposits, and that's where the oil comes from, like marsh deposits and things. So the salts that come out came from the ocean when it was here, like geologists think, you know, millions and millions of years ago. So the salt that's in the water is very similar to the recent like oceans that we have today.
Brine, what role does it play in the fracking process?
So they don't really use brine in the fracking process. They more use it, they get it out of the water. It's almost like a byproduct. So they take the oil and the gas and the brine is kind of leftover water. They actually use fresh water for fracking. So the fracking water is, they kind of put a few chemicals in there to help break the oil out of the formations. But for the most part, they're pretty separate. So the produced water is completely different from the fracking water.
Generally speaking, and I know that these, the chemical components of what oil companies use for fracking is somewhat proprietary information, but generally speaking, what chemicals or radioactive materials might be in this produced water?
Yeah, and there's not really radioactive right off the bat either. That's the radioactivity comes from what's called TNORM, or technically enhanced natural occurring radioactive materials. So that's from like pumping, you know, millions and millions of gallons through pipes. You might have a little bit that comes out over time. Just like if you're mining gold, you'd mine a giant hillside to get an ounce of gold. It's similar like that with radioactive. So it's really not a big issue. It's more gets caught in like the pipes and things like that as they're producing and this type of stuff.
So what about chemicals? Are there other chemicals that you traditionally find?
Like in the natural produced water, Yeah. It's not real chemicals. It's very close to seawater. I mean, it's kind of similar. It's got some more chlorides, things like that in it. Just like every aquifer in North Dakota and every farm well is a little bit different chemistry. It's the same with each formation. But it's no real toxic chemicals in the produced water. The problem with the produced water is it's a very high salt concentration. So if you spill it on land, it kills everything. So if we spill oil out from a pipeline, it's actually really easy to clean up in the winter. It's, a lot of times it doesn't even break the snow. So oil is very easy to clean up in the field. where salt water penetrates into the ground can get into groundwater if it's in the right place.
So. And in this case in Williams County, it was a 3.1 million gallon spill. Is that a moderately sized spill?
Yep, that's fairly significant. And it's, you know, they have a lot of good monitoring things on the pipelines as well. So, you know, the pressure here, the pressure there have to match. And if they are different, they have automatic systems that shut them down and everything too. So they monitor them pretty well. So they're able to shut the well down and stop it from continuing to kind of contaminate, I guess.
So how is brine typically then stored and transported? And in this case, it was a pipeline that leaked.
Yeah, and pipelines are by far the safest means of transportation. You know, you don't have a lot of human error in those. When things happen, it can be related to the weather or something else, where, you know, rail is probably the next safest. And again, not a lot of things. And then there's truck transportation. Some of the smaller wells will use trucks to transport the salt water back and forth, and that's where you actually probably have more spills, but they're less significant. So pipelines by far the safest, but also when they do happen, it tends to be a little bit bigger spills.
This isn't the first brine spill that's happened in North Dakota.
No, there's, if DEQ's got a site, there's everything from someone spills like a bucket sized or something like that, or a barrel. All those are reported and can be looked up on the DEQ site. Department of DEQ in North Dakota and the NDAC are the two regulatory authorities. So anytime a producer spills, they report it to them and get them involved immediately.
Reportedly, this spill contaminated a nearby grassy land and unnamed tributary leading to Stony Creek, but didn't reach Stony Creek. Is that your understanding?
Yes, yeah, that's kind of what I've seen on this one. And I haven't been out to the site personally on that one, but that's, yeah, what's being reported. And we've done dozens, if not, you know, close to 100 of these, where over the years with different companies, different states I've worked in. And when they do happen, again, first thing you do is stop the pipeline or the leak, the source of the leak. Then you kind of contain what's there, put berms in place, block culvert so it doesn't spread, and then you remove the free material. So anything basically that's in a puddle, you know, anything you can suck up with a vac truck, you get that out of there, and then you take the first 4, 5, 6 inches of soil, remove them, and once that's gone, then you kind of come back and assess how much has to be cleaned up, so.
Typically, in this case, how long does that take?
One this size probably can take up to 3-4 months, just based on the size of whatever. So, yeah.
Enjoying our discussion with John Ellingson. He is a licensed professional geologist, a certified professional geologist, and he is operations manager at Terracon, an environmental consulting company. What are the short and long-term potential impacts and risks for lands and communities that are then exposed to this brine water, and can the immediacy a cleanup pretty much negate any long-term risks?
Yeah, and I think for the most part that's true. As long as we get out there right away, can mitigate and kind of reduce or absolutely remove all the risks associated with that. The biggest effect really is on vegetation. Some of these wells that were produced back in the 60s, they would dig a pit on site, put cuttings in them, and they were saturated with salt. Now over the last 70 years, they've kind of migrated out to, like, in Bottineau County. Some of the older wells have those issues, so it's more to the farmland, so risk to the farmland, production, acreage. As long as it doesn't get in an aquifer, you're safe. And I don't, you know, there's no real big ones where aquifers have been, you know, contaminated. But yeah, so immediate effects is not really. You just get out there, clean that spill up as quick as you can. I always tell people with a spill, it's like spilling a glass of juice or something like that on your carpet. You know, it's like you can spill it in your, so it all depends on where it's spilled to. Like I said, if this was a flat area, dry land, farmland, grassland, they're pretty easy to clean up. I always say the example of if you spill a glass of wine in your sink, it doesn't really matter. You know, you can clean it up easily. It's just, so if it's on a pad where there's berms and there's geomembrane lining the pad, it's not a big deal. And then, you know, if you spill it on your linoleum floor in the kitchen, you wipe it off with a paper towel. You know, you spill it in your dining room on the hardwood, it's kind of more of a you know, you wipe it off the paper towel, but you got to get a little bit more. And it's the same with cleaning. So if you do it in a dry area, not a big deal. Flat area, not a big deal. But if you get in those tributary streams, then you're starting to, you know, spill it on your carpet, and you can still get it out. It just takes a little bit more effort.
How effective are these monitoring systems, and what are they? How is it that they knew that this accident had occurred? What happens in that process?
Yeah, so our regulators do a really good job on that, make sure all that stuff's being kept up. We have Pipeline Authority and the NDIC, DEQ, all do a really good job. But basically, like, it measures the pressure going in, and if that pressure is reduced at the other end, they know something's leaking. So they have auto shutdown systems. Like, my family farm's got pipeline going through it in the center of the state. And, you know, I see airplanes going by, I don't know, a couple times a week probably. So they monitor, you know, from the air, they monitor with those type of systems and really do a pretty good job. There's people checking all the crossings I see out there almost every week, driving and just making sure everything's in place. So visual, they have drones that fly over and check thermal in the wintertime, and or all year round, but you can see if there's any leaks, or even just like a pinhole leak will show up on some of those drone footage.
Is this something visually you can see then? It seems to me like if it's salt water just kind of dumped onto land, it may not be as visible to my eye.
Yeah, and actually people probably call in or will see oil easier because it's, you know, it's black and it stains material. The salt water, if there's a very slow leak in maybe a smaller pipeline or something where they can't detect that pressure, and the bigger ones they can detect it really easy, but the smaller ones, it'll be more of a pinhole leak, and you won't really see that with brine until everything's dead. And then you got to go in and fix it at that point.
So once you do your remediation process, is it ever the case that you thought you were done, but you really weren't and have to do more?
Once in a while, yeah. So, and also there's limits that you can do sometimes if you're right at the edge of a wetland or something and you clean up everything, but you may not want to disturb that wetland. It'll cause more damage to, it'll take, you know, 30 years to get that wetland back to what it was. Sometimes that marginal material, they let you keep in place, and it'll, like, through phytoremediation where the vegetation actually kind of sucks the salts out of the soil, kind of put some of those methods in. So with remediation, we do like what's called a combined system approach. So you remove it and you stop, you know, get all the source, get 90% of it. And then in those sensitive areas where they don't want you to go in and dig, some of those phytoremediation techniques or trenching, things like that, can clean it as well. So some we check, like every year we come back and make sure on those systems.
So who oversees your work from a regulatory perspective?
NDIC and DEQ are the two big ones. And then if something does happen on like Forest Service or something, then they're involved as well. But DEQ kind of has authority off the pad, and NDIC has the authority like on or right adjacent to the pad.
So are there any regulatory gaps that exist at the state or federal level when it comes to managing these risks? Or do you believe that we're as effective as we can be to regulate fracking brine?
I think we are pretty good right now. And like I said, you learn something different from every spill, but they've been happening, you know, over time for 50, 75 years. So, you know, the pipes are getting better, the systems are getting better, the regulatory agencies are getting better. So I think every spill you learn something, but I think most lessons have been learned at this point, and I think they do a pretty good job. And their cleanup kind of criteria is very good too. Like, we did a lot of research for the state a couple years ago, testing different amendments and cleanups of brine material. Wrote some manuals on that, and you know, the levels that they have set are very accurate. So they want everything below 2000 EC, which is electric conductivity, and all our research showed that anything under 2000, we had 100% germination, everything was growing great. So I think they've set the levels over time very appropriately and very good. And the state just does a great job. Although I've worked in many other states across the US, and the North Dakota team is really good.
My takeaway from this discussion may be that pipelines are the safest. Oftentimes, pipelines make the news of people very concerned about something like this that happened, but it's in fact the safest method of transportation.
Yep, absolutely. And like I said, I have a pipeline going through our family land, and nothing's ever happened, but if it did happen, you know, they'd be out there and clean it up immediately. I have a farm near Heimdall, North Dakota, and they had a derailment out there. The rail did, I know, a dozen plus years ago, kind of in the middle of the rush, and you know, they were out there and cleaned that up and took care of it. It happened about 50 yards past my land on the other side of the tracks, but it was very close to my land. But the, you know, so I'm familiar with the farmers out there, and it's, you know, actually. They did a great job cleaning up, never know it was there. And actually, I think they made a new road for us back there too, so it probably is better than it was when they started. So like I said, it's kind of like spilling something on your carpet. You don't leave it.
So no, if you could, if you could reduce this conversation to what you would like the public to know about a brine spill, and in particular, maybe even this brine spill that occurred in Williams County, what would you tell our listeners?
Typically, you know, like everyone's scared of oil spills, and brine's not a big deal, it seems like, because it's a type of water. But in reality, oil spills are actually very easy to clean up, and they stay at the surface and they're pretty easy to take care of. Brine spills are more severe because they can get kind of into the groundwater, things like that. But at the same time, whenever they happen, they hire a consultant like us or someone else to go out and take care and clean that up. And we've got a lot of great contractors, and the regulatory authority does a wonderful job in the state with NDIC and DEQ, just great individuals to work with. And so if it does happen, it does happen on your land, they're going to put it back to the way it was. And, you know, there's always the case out there, or maybe that wasn't the thing, or 40 years ago they didn't do it right, but today with the companies in North Dakota, they're great companies, great regulators. So
as we wrap up the conversation, who then pays for this remediation?
That's the companies, the producers. If it's either the pipeline company doing it or the company that's producing the oil, so, or water.
My guest has been John Ellingson. He's a certified professional geologist. He's the operations manager at Terracon. Our discussion happened here in Fargo, although you travel all over the state, John. Is that right?
Yep.
Thanks so much for joining us on Main Street.
All right. Thank you. Have a good day.
Main Street continues today on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. The timeless stories of William Shakespeare are coming to life under the North Dakota sky. The North Dakota Shakespeare Festival is entering its ninth season, and this year's performances will be staged not only in Grand Forks, but also for the first time in Medora. Joining us are Stephanie Fotz-Murray, the festival's producing artistic director, and Kurt Toftiland, a North Dakota native whose impact on the theater world includes founding Shakespeare Behind Bars, an extraordinary program that stages Shakespeare inside prisons. We'll explore the power of performance, redemption, and what makes Shakespeare resonate with audiences old and new. Stephanie and Kurt, welcome to Main Street.
Thank you so much for having us.
Pleasure that you are both with us today. Stephanie, let's start with you. This is the ninth year of the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival. How has the festival grown and changed since its founding? And let us know the dates and locations of this festival this year.
Absolutely. Like a lot of theater companies, I think there's been ebb and flow since the post-pandemic era. We initially started directly as part of the University of North Dakota, and we rehearsed on campus. The university was really heavily involved because I was a faculty member at the university. And I moved on to another position, so the company is sort of naturally matriculated from there to become its own entity. And now we are fiscally sponsored by the Community Foundation in Grand Forks, so we still have intentional community ties in Grand Forks. And this year we are back on campus rehearsing with the theater department and the theater department spaces. So that has kind of come full circle again, which is really wonderful.
So when is the festival?
The festival this year in Grand Forks is June 12th through the 21st. We have 8 public performances in Grand Forks. And then we travel to Medora and we have 10 public performances there, June 26th through July 7th.
Kurt, you're directing this year's production and you've worked all over the country, even in prisons. What's it like returning to North Dakota to direct a show like this that you'll perform in both Grand Forks and Medora?
Well, very sentimental. I still have family that live in North Dakota, and so I visit and have visited often. I graduated from the University of North Dakota. I've been skipping a decade. I've been saying 41 years ago. It's actually 51 years ago. 1974. So it's a great homecoming to be back in North Dakota and back on the campus of my undergraduate years.
Stephanie, one of the big new developments that we've talked about is performing in Medora. What led to the expansion and what makes it so exciting?
Well, actually, I reached out to them a few years ago and we had had a conversation and it ended up not coming to fruition. And they have a new staff member who's interested in offering some different sorts of entertainment that maybe are outside of Medora's sort of traditional brand. So he said, wouldn't it be awesome if you could bring a Shakespeare production, but maybe it has a bit of a Majorah flair. So I won't give too much away, but there is a historical figure, let's say, that will appear that you might associate with Majorah.
A former president, maybe?
A little bit less direct than the true historical figure, but it will look like a certain historical figure. And we were really thrilled that they approached us this past year about the partnership. One of our company goals long term is to really become the Festival of North Dakota. We are called North Dakota Shakespeare Festival, but in reality have mostly been the Grand Forks Shakespeare Festival. But one of our goals is to try to expand and reach the entire state. So I think starting with the two coasts, we've been saying we're bi-coastal this season, seems like a logical first step to see if there is interest on the west side of North Dakota and how we might be able to expand from there.
Kurt, we'll jump back to this year's Shakespeare Festival in just a minute, but your work with Shakespeare Behind Bars is remarkable. Give us a snapshot, if you would, of how that began and what impacts that it's had.
Well, the root comes from, I think, the human being that founds anything, and that is, I've always been a caregiver. I'm the eldest of five children, so it started there. We're only 7 years apart, youngest to oldest, and then I was raised in Martin, North Dakota, a very small rural community in the middle of North Dakota, and so you have to take care of each other. Farmers take care of the town people take care of the farmers, and so I was raised in a very nurturing environment. My heart always went to the outcasts, to the ones that were teased or kicked aside. And that continued then into the arts. And I continued as a teaching artist, working with the marginalized communities, which eventually led me to working in juvenile detention. And then that gatewayed to working in adult prison. And I've now been working in corrections for 34 years. So it starts with the person, and then it just grows, and the belief, the profound belief that arts can heal. And heal in particular traumas that people have suffered in their lifetimes.
Transformative, if you will.
Yes.
Stephanie, for those who are intimidated by Shakespeare, and I'm raising my hand, it was a struggle for me to get through Othello when I was a freshman in college, but I did. But how do you make his work feel fresh and accessible for modern audiences?
I think that starts with hiring directors who are willing to embrace who our community is. You know, we are not trying to cater to the elite scholarly Shakespeare community. We're trying to cater to the North Dakota community. So when I hire directors, that's typically a question I ask: do you feel comfortable acknowledging that's our audience and creating a production for that audience? So a lot of times that manifests itself in the concept. For instance, Majorah sort of requested our concept this year, but it definitely has a bit of a prairie flair to it. Also the language, we even throughout rehearsals will change some words. Yesterday, for instance, we're in rehearsal and one of the characters uses the word Hinds, and Kurt said, nobody knows what Hinds are, just say hogs. So we will sometimes intentionally change words here and there to make it clearer to the audience what the story is, because if we don't have an audience, then why are we doing it?
Is that hard for you to incorporate into these productions when you consider what Shakespeare is, but you want to make it more accessible? Is that a tough thing to do?
It really isn't. Sadly, Shakespeare got put up on a pedestal, an intellectual pedestal, and became I don't mean this in a derogatory way, but it may sound that way. But when it went into English departments and out of theater departments, and English departments got a hold of it, then it all became about the language and the interpretation of the language, et cetera, et cetera. And Shakespeare is meant to be performed. Shakespeare was created for primarily an illiterate society. Groundlings went and paid threepence to stand and watch the plays. What I love about Shakespeare is he doesn't dumb down his work. He had a fantastic vocabulary, so he was educating his audience by expanding their vocabulary. So for me, it's just about taking Shakespeare back to his origins, which is providing entertainment for the masses. And I work in, as you said earlier, in corrections, and some of my participants are literate. Some of them have third grade reading skills. Some of them have English as a second language. So they comprehend it and seize upon it and find the story that is there. And it's a dramatized story. So for me, it's not difficult to look at it and say, what would Shakespeare do? Well, Shakespeare would want his audience to understand what he was saying. So again, we don't dumb down the Shakespeare, we just make it more accessible.
I want to ask both of you, as we kind of wind up our conversation, what you hope North Dakota audiences expect and will take away from your productions of Shakespeare this summer. Stephanie, I'll start with you.
I hope they expect to have a good time, to have fun and enjoy the work. And I think more often than not, patrons leave our shows saying, wow, I got a lot more of that than I thought I would.
Kurt, how about you?
It is certainly about that piece of it. And that is, Shakespeare is, number one, a great storyteller. This is a great story. As You Like It is a wonderful play. It is a pastoral comedy. There is, of course, some villainy in it, because Shakespeare wouldn't be Shakespeare without some villainy. But it really, what I love about Shakespeare is he really divides people into decent people and indecent people. Sometimes decent people do indecent things. Sometimes indecent people do decent things. And that's all captured in the story. Plus, the primary part of the story, the major part of the story is pastoral, which means it's taking place in an agrarian society, which I think North Dakotans get.
Stephanie, one more time, give us the dates and how people can learn more and get tickets.
We'll be performing As You Like It in Grand Forks, June 12th through the 21st, and in Medora, June 26th through July 7th. You can find details at NorthDakotaShakespeare.com.
My guests today have been Stephanie Fotz-Murray and Kurt Tofteland with the North Dakota Shakespeare Festival. Their summer season kicks off soon with performances in Grand Forks and Medora. And Stephanie just told us the dates and where you can learn more. Whether you're a seasoned Shakespeare fan or stepping into the world of the Bard for the first time, this is a season worth seeing under the stars here in North Dakota. Stephanie and Kurt, thank you so much for joining us today on Main Street.
Thanks so much for having us. And it's also worth mentioning they're free.
Can't have a better deal than that. Thanks again.
Thank you, Craig.
Still to come on Main Street, Dr. Tom Easern with a Plainsfolk essay, our weekly feature, Our Living Lands, and This Week in Water, and more. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today in this Plainsfolk essay, Dr. Tom Easern brings us a tale of past flowers, parades, and the politics of pride as he digs into how and why Norwegian Independence Day came late to the Dakotas.
During the early heyday of Norwegian immigration to the Northern Plains, during the first Dakota boom of the 1880s, nobody celebrated Sitting to Mai. Occasionally, a newspaper doing its best to make a cultural translation would note on 17 September the occurrence of what it called Norwegian Independence Day. A nice try, only a little premature. Norwegian Independence Day would be 7th of June, marking the day in 1905 that Norway dissolved its official ties to the tyrannous Swedes. Sitting to Mai, rather, commemorates the signing of the Norwegian Constitution at Eidsvoll in 1814. Gratulerer med dagen is an appropriate greeting for your Norwegian friends on either date. It was after the latter date of Norwegian independence in 1905 that Sitting to Mai celebrations emerged like pasque flowers on the prairies. Suddenly, communities needed monuments to Grieg, Asen, Bjornsson, Vergeland, and even the rapacious rover Rollo. The early 20th century became a time of wondrous resurgence for immigrant identity, specific immigrant identity. Arguably, peak Norsk occurred on the 17th of May, 1906, on which holiday the Norwegians of Grand Forks heralded the establishment of a Scandinavian library at the University of North Dakota. Actually, the observance spanned 3 days, with the main event in the Metropolitan Theater on the 17th. As the papers reported, the city is full of the brave sons and fair daughters of romantic Norway. Professor John Tingelstad had been gathering volumes for the library, more than 1,000 already. Hired in 1901, he was the first full-time professor of Scandinavian languages at the university. delivering on the law passed by the legislature in 1891 requiring the teaching of Scandinavian languages. And here, owing to the honest documentation provided by the Norwegian Language Program at UND, I have to note a disturbing rhetorical undercurrent emerging at the earliest stages of Norwegian consciousness in the state. It seems that Norwegian immigrants from Fargo had insisted as early as 1884 that a representative of their race, that's the word they used, must be appointed to the UND faculty. The big address on 17 September 1906 was by Aksel Jorgensen Grana of Lakota, a member of the Board of Trustees and the key mover behind the Scandinavian Library. Grana, a second-generation Norwegian, was a rising Republican who would serve in the U.S. Congress and Senate as a prominent progressive and isolationist. Grana took pains to portray Norwegians as the best sort of immigrant stock, as true and loyal citizens. He argued that the United States had become a great nation simply because it had permitted people from all parts of the world to share and participate in the great wealth and blessings this country had in store. Grana made it plain, however, that in addition to democratic values and a work ethic, an essential quality of these laudable immigrants was that they were of the Caucasian race, and he used those words. He was liberally inclusive of a catalog of desirable immigrants. The practical Englishman, the philosophical German, the polite Frenchman, the sturdy Scandinavian, the brawny Scotsman, and the witty son of the Emerald Isle. Utterly absent from his exposition are the people who, at the time of his speaking, had pushed annual immigration totals above 1 million per year, the new immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. So, gratulerer med dagen, my Nordic friends. Perhaps you and I might talk a little more about what we celebrate.
That's our good friend, Dr. Tom Easern. He's a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University, and he weekly contributes his Plainsfolk essays to our Prairie Public Audience.
This is Bird Note. Can birdsong inspire great music? It certainly caught the ear of Italian composer Antonio Vivaldi, widely celebrated for his exuberant, playful melodies. Vivaldi even named a 1729 flute concerto for a bird, the goldfinch. The flute is perhaps the instrument best suited to recreating the whistled sounds of songbirds. Vivaldi's Goldfinch Concerto, or Il Gardellino, challenges the flute to imitate the bird's silvery trills and sweetly warbled phrases, even its plaintive notes. The source of Vivaldi's inspiration? The European goldfinch. It's a tiny bird found throughout much of Europe, where it frequents gardens and roadsides. And it has the looks to match its sparkling song. Its striking red and white face is set off by yellow and black wings. No wonder Vivaldi found the goldfinch irresistible. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by A Taste of Ireland, a live music and dance production featuring international Irish dance champions, coming to Grand Forks June 8th. Information at atasteofirelandshow.com.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The West is known for its spectacular outdoor recreation, but for Indigenous communities, access to activities like fly fishing has been difficult. Our Living Lands producer Daniel Spalding spoke to Tristan Chi, a Navajo filmmaker, about his new film documenting One Camp's work to change that.
Can you share a little bit about your film Rooted Waters and what inspired you to document the Indigenous and Hispanic youth fly fishing camp?
I myself grew up on the Navajo Reservation. I was in an area where water access was very limited. We had one close lake that was nearby, and you know, just grew up fishing with regular spin rods. But fly fishing was never that everyday activity that I didn't grow up with. So being able to be a part of this community here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, really led me to other people who are doing really great work, other leaders who are doing really great work in their area. And one of those was Indigenous and Hispanic Youth Fly Fishing Camp, which is led by another great leader from Santa Clara Pueblo, Vidal Gonzalez. That's how it all started, was, you know, for the community, by the community, and by someone who is of that community. And that's really the main reason why the story came about.
And so Rooted Waters showcases stunning footage of New Mexico's trout streams. What were some of the challenges and rewards of capturing these natural landscapes on film?
You know, the fly fishing film was primarily around the resources of water and where trout basically can live and adapt to. So we have been fishing these areas for, you know, quite a long time, and especially the Pueblo people. So the way that I like to lead my storytelling is to know that these areas are ancestral homelands to a local tribe, and reaching out to the tribe and knowledge keepers there about areas that are special and sacred, and that should not be on film. And the physical filming of it was, you know, using cinematic grade cameras and drone footage, carrying gear in and out of these places. Sometimes the place we would hike into would be about, you know, a mile and a half long, and they would be easily about, you know, 1,000-foot elevation drop within that mile and gain up in that area. So it was pretty difficult, but it was also very fun.
What environmental shifts or climate-related changes did you observe while filming, you know, along the streams and the rivers in New Mexico?
When we were out there, we did see quite a lot, heard a lot, and felt a lot in our senses. And the biggest thing was pretty much the heat. The heat was, you know, super hot in moments where it should not have been. The waters are, you know, not the way they used to be. The levels aren't the way they used to be. And the trout aren't really in the areas where they used to be as well. But we were still, you know, catching them. There is still water out here, which is we're grateful for. And trees are still here. It really instills that conservation mindset into these kids and into ourselves of, you know, we need to protect these landscapes more than the way we have been.
How do you see fly fishing and outdoor education as tools for building climate resilience and environmental awareness among Indigenous and Latino youth?
Yeah. So amongst our communities, we, you know, don't really have a lot of accessibility to the outdoors. And I think the thing about this camp and what it provides is that it really provides knowledge, cultural and traditional knowledge of generations. And the camp also includes elders of these communities to come out to speak on traditional and cultural knowledge of these places we're fishing at, and to, you know, talk about how important it is to take care of Mother Earth, how important it is to take care of the things around you and treat things with respect, and also, you know, give offerings, because what we're doing there is, you know, we're extracting, we're in their environment, and, you know, we've got to leave it better than the way we left it.
What role do you believe storytelling, you know, especially through film, can play in advancing climate action and preserving sacred waters for future generations?
The thing about this is that storytelling and filmmaking go, you know, they coincide, they work together. And to make a really great story is to have someone and something connected in that relation who are wanting to protect, wanting to build something in order to protect, in order to thrive, in order to be resilient.
That was Tristan Chi, director of Rooted Waters, which premiered on May 23rd, 2025 at the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Mm-hmm. The oceans are getting darker. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
People who depend on the Colorado River received a grim prediction last week that Lake Powell, the second largest reservoir in the basin, will have less water, which could mean cutbacks in the future.
The snowpack at the beginning of April was less than normal, and the spring has been very warm and dry in the Rocky Mountains, which has led to low runoff.
Currently, Lake Powell is at 31% capacity, and Lake Mead, the largest reservoir in the country, is at 32% after about 25 years of severe drought.
Officials in the seven states of the Colorado River Basin, including Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California, met last week and have yet to come to an agreement on how they'll share water in the coming years after the existing guidelines expire at the end of 2026. If no agreement is reached, the federal government will likely impose its own plan that could lead to much litigation.
Meanwhile, a new study came out showing that ground and surface water in the Colorado River Basin have been depleted during the last 20 years by an amount equivalent to the total capacity of Lake Mead.
Jay Fomalietti, the senior author of the study, told The Guardian that groundwater is disappearing nearly 2.5 times faster than surface water. He added that everyone in the U.S. should be worried about the crisis in the Southwest because much of the country's food is grown there.
Meanwhile, a controversial plan to transport crude oil by rail along portions of the Colorado River is much closer to becoming a reality after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned a lower court's decision.
Environmental groups in Eagle County, Colorado, home of Vail Ski Resort, had challenged an agency decision that will allow the 2-mile-long trains to ship crude oil from Utah's Uinta Basin to the Gulf Coast.
They argued that the Surface Transportation Board did not weigh the downstream effects should a tanker derail and pollute the Colorado River, threatening the environment and communities.
Additionally, they said the agency had not considered how refining 5 billion gallons of additional oil per year would exacerbate global warming.
An appellate court agreed, but the Supreme Court, in a unanimous decision, with Justice Gorsuch recusing himself, decided that some judges have incorrectly reviewed agency decisions under the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA.
Justice Kavanaugh, writing for the court, said that overly intrusive judicial review has led to delay upon delay and higher costs. NEPA, he continued, is to inform decision-making, not paralyze it.
NEPA requires federal agencies to assess the environmental effects of proposed major actions prior to making decisions. However, this case narrows the scope of all environmental reviews of major infrastructure projects like highways and pipelines.
The world's oceans are getting darker. That's the conclusion of a new study out last week that says there's cause for concern.
Ocean darkening occurs when sunlight and moonlight can't penetrate the upper layers of the ocean called the photic zone, which is home to 90% of all marine life and one of the most productive habitats on Earth.
According to researchers from the University of Plymouth in the UK, over 1/5 of the global ocean has darkened over the past 2 decades.
Typically, darkening can occur near coastlines because of agricultural runoff and increased rainfall, making the waters murkier. But this new research shows that it's happening in the open ocean, which they suggest could be from hotter temperatures causing increased algal blooms that reduce light penetration. It could also be the result of changes in ocean circulation patterns driven by global warming.
The researchers found that the most prominent shifts in the open ocean were at the top of the Gulf Stream and around both the Arctic and Antarctic.
The authors suggest that a shrinking photic zone in the upper ocean would create intense competition among marine life for resources and negatively affect food webs and global fisheries.
And finally, the word kuleana in the Hawaiian language means a responsibility to take care of one another and to take care of the aina, the land.
On May 27th, Governor Josh Green invoked those terms when he signed a new green fee law that will add a tax on hotel stays to protect the environment in the face of climate change. It's a first for the state and for the country.
The new fee is a response to the increased risk of natural disasters driven by global warming, like the wildfires on Maui in 2023. The revenue will provide funding for environmental stewardship, hazard mitigation, and sustainable tourism, which together will enhance the island's resiliency.
The new law means that visitors would pay around $3 on a $400 hotel room per night. It will also apply to short-term rentals as well as to cruise ships, a sector that has long gone untaxed. The green fee goes into effect next January.
Hawaii joins a list of places around the world like Greece, Bali, and the Galapagos Islands where fees are being implemented in recognition that tourism, while economically vital, must be managed responsibly to protect the fragile ecosystems that many people come to see from the growing impacts of climate change.
That's it for this week in water. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Hear the past come to life on Dakota Datebook 5 times a day, Monday through Friday, on Prairie Public. We tell North Dakota's story one colorful character at a time. Dakota Datebook, your daily dose of North Dakota history on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 3rd. When Reverend I.O. Sloan set foot in Bismarck in 1873, it was a wild and woolly western town. Bismarck had a few new wood-framed buildings, but it was teeming with tents and gamblers, and loud profanity prevailed. Although it seemed likely that Bismarck's rougher residents would rather go to a bear fight than to church, Isaac O. Sloan, the 53-year-old Presbyterian preacher, held a church service on June 15, 1873. Sloan conducted the worship in a brand new tent, and it was filled with people. Every place of business was closed during the church hour, out of respect. After the service, businesses reopened, and blacksmith George Gibbs' booming voice could be heard all over town shouting several times, "Hurrah for God!" A legend grew. Some newspaper reporters printed false claims that gamblers had thrown poker chips into the offering plate. But a contemporary observer said that wasn't true. The service was reverently conducted, and the congregation behaved with the same dignity and decorum as any church back east. It was a momentous occasion. That very day, Bismarck's leading citizens, including newspaperman Clement Lounsbury and three others, organized a Presbyterian congregation. Reverend Sloan became their minister, and they began work on a church building. After several years in Bismarck, Sloan moved to Mandan and built a church there as well. Years later, he founded yet another church. It was on this date, in 1892, that a newspaper mentioned the Glencoe Church, southeast of Bismarck. Reverend Sloan had a unique background. Born in 1820 in Philadelphia, he was educated at Pennsylvania's Jefferson College and Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He served a church in Virginia from 1856 until the Civil War. During the war, President Lincoln appointed him hospital chaplain. Sloan comforted wounded and dying soldiers in field hospitals until the war's end in 1865. After the war, he moved west, serving churches in Minnesota and then in Dakota Territory, where he became a beloved preacher known for living by Christ's words, "Love one another." Reverend Sloan retired in 1895 at the age of 75. He returned to Philadelphia, where he passed away in 1899 at the age of 79. The congregation that began in 1873 still meets today, generations after Reverend Sloan's arrival in Bismarck. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Hoffbeck. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Starian Bank, determined to provide smart banking solutions with innovative checking accounts and personal banking tools that match your lifestyle. Starian, taking you farther. Learn more at StarianBank.com.
Did you know that when you support Prairie Public's radio service starting as little as $5 a month, you'll receive access to one of our best Prairie Public member benefits, PBS Passport. Passport lets you stream your favorite PBS shows on your Roku, Fire Stick, Apple TV, or Smart TV. Watch the programs you love all on your own time. Unlock entire seasons of programs early and discover new TV series, movies, and musical performances, all available to you when you support Prairie Public, your local NPR and PBS station.
And that's a wrap for today's edition of Main Street here on Prairie Public. Thank you so much for joining us today. Tomorrow on the show, another edition of Prairie Plates, Rick Gion brings us an interview with Molly Yeh, and Chef Sarah Watson stops by the Main Street studio to talk about her sold-out book, Cabin Chef. That's ahead tomorrow on Main Street, and we hope you'll join us again.